Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome, everyone, to a Tuesday edition of the Damage Report. Let's go ahead and do it. Welcome, friends. Welcome, family. What's up, Ma? Welcome, you guys, yes, to the Damage Report. I'm J.R. Jackson, filling in for John Adarola, who is out at the moment because my man is dealing with life. Beautiful life. It's all things going down with him. But you know what, you guys, today we're going to go ahead and dive into the news as usual. You guys probably know what's going on, but you know, to help me out with this, because I haven't had the chance to really talk, speak, interact with my people in quite some time. I'm a little bit fiending here. So here we go. David Schuster joins me on the program today. Yes, that David Schuster. What's going on, David? How are you feeling? Way out there.
Where are we? What time is it? Who's showing? Oh, okay. All right. JR, it is great to be on with you. And you know what? I have a feeling you and I together, we're going to make John rethink his views on family leave and everything else. Anyway.
Hopefully, I mean, in one way or another, either good or bad, we're going to find it for sure as we dive into this stuff, you guys. Just full disclosure, you guys. As you guys know, I do the watch list as well. And as we did that daily show on the regular, David and I would chop it up, get into things. So let's really fast, David. I don't think I didn't see the Michigan colors that you're rocking today. You do it purposefully when you come around me. I was actually going to wear SC things, but I'm not fully sure yet what's going to go down. I have to follow it closer. But are you feeling good about the season first for all those Michiganders out there and maybe those Buckeyes that could be worried?
I'm feeling great. I think this will be Michigan's best team in like, you know, 80 years. They are so loaded. They are so stacked. They are so motivated. I mean, it should be a cakewalk through the Big Ten and then all the way to the national championship. The question is, you know, can they beat Georgia? I think they will. I think Michigan's just going to roll. I think they're going to win most games by 40 or 50 points and then beat Ohio State by another 30 again. It'll be a great season.
I continue to have a soft spot for Michigan, my number two choice. Just, I have to tell you guys every time. Thank you again for being with us. Let's go ahead and jump into this, because you know what? What else should be a cakewalk is what's going down with Donald Trump and yet more indictments. Let's go.
One more indictment that I think this election's over. One more. I did everything right and they indicted me.
They indicted me just again. Yes, Donald Trump now up for more indictments. Yes, 91 crimes and 4 criminal cases now for Donald Trump. 4 different jurisdictions. And now with this Georgia indictment coming public, this is just yet another. So Donald Trump and 18 other allies were indicted in Georgia on Monday over their efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Yes, we've heard about these things, from the Raffensperger phone call to trying to change up electors to lying about what people are doing and voting machines and everything else that they could possibly do. That's what Donald Trump is now up on. Let's go to some of these details, because it got even further now, because it's looking like a criminal enterprise type of association that's going on just to keep him in power. Let's jump straight into this from the AP. The nearly 100-page indictment details dozens of acts by Trump or his allies to undo his defeat. That includes beseeching Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to find enough votes for him to win in this battleground state, harassing an election worker who faced false claims of fraud, and attempting to persuade Georgia lawmakers to ignore the will of voters and appoint a new slate of Electoral College electors favorable to Trump. In one primary brazen episode, it also outlines a plot involving one of his lawyers to access voting machines in a rural Georgia county and steal data from a voting machine company. Insanity. So again, criminal enterprise type of stuff, because they had so many different angles and directions that they were going about trying to overturn this election, and he's still on that same tip. Check it out. Caitlin Collins is also on CNN talking about some of these other folks that have been indicted. Let's check this out.
It's not just Trump's name is on this, but it's the others that are on this. And so we've got Donald John Trump, Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Mark Meadows is on here, Jake. Ken Cheeseborough, that's another unindicted co-conspirator in the previous indictment. Jeffrey Clark, that's the former Justice Department official that wanted to be named the acting attorney general, nearly did. Jenna Ellis, the Trump attorney. Ray Smith, another attorney. Robert Cheley. Mike Roman, that's the Trump campaign official who was handling fake electors in that time period, Jake, from the election through December. He's someone who's also been part of he had met with investigators in Jack Smith's investigation. His name is on here. And David James Schaefer, that I believe is the top former Republican official. He was in a campaign fundraising role.
Some names that you guys probably recognize, some big names you recognize that are on that list as a part of this whole plot, filling this whole thing out. So all 19 of them, Trump and his co-defendants, also had to surrender by August 25th. Yes, surrender for these charges. We'll see how much more of this is going to go down that way. But let's look at a few more of these charges, Dave, before we let you in on where this could possibly go. Because these are some of these counts that are included and what it is that they did as a bit of a breakdown. Let's check this out. 22 counts related to forgery or false documents and statements. More related to soliciting or impersonating public officers. This is serious stuff. 3 more related to influencing witnesses. 3 more related to election fraud or defrauding the state. 3 more related to computer tampering. Another related to racketeering, yeah. And another related to perjury. So the idea is, he thinks, as we started off here, that more charges, more me getting more attention. Maybe I can get back into the White House. Because again, the whole point here is to avoid all these things that he was trying to do. Because he thought the first wave would work. When it didn't, they have to shift to other things. Many of these 161 acts by Trump and his associates outlined in this Georgia indictment, they've already been seeing a lot of attention, as we talked about. We've heard the perfect phone call and just find me 11,872, whatever he said, more votes. That's one more than we need. It's all been out there in plain sight. Now, finally, we have actual indictments coming that way. Before we get to more of those charges by Trump specifically, first thoughts here, though, David. We see it over and over again. As we talked about, 91 different criminal counts and all these things, 4 different indictments, how many different jurisdictions. But the thing is they keep coming with this positivity. Is it all fake?
Well, what's so interesting, JR, is if you look at the federal indictments, which were very sort of narrow, precise, pointed, and it looks like down in Georgia, Fannie Willis took more of the everything thrown against the wall. And I would argue that she probably got evidence to support it all, but instead of a narrowly tailored indictment, she's going with sort of the gunshot approach. It's a little bit unusual for her to say, as she did last night, that she wants to try all of them at the same time. That's sort of unfathomable. However, the one thing that sort of jumps out to me, JR, is that as I was reading about this, the racketeering laws are actually, it's easier to prove racketeering and convict somebody in racketeering under Georgia law than it is literally under the federal statutes. Georgia is one of those sort of oddball sort of states in a way on this, in which the laws, it's a lot easier for a prosecutor in Georgia than most other states when it comes to racketeering, and certainly easier than the federal government. So I used to be of the mindset that, well, you should always let the federal cases go first and local prosecutors wait their turn and then they bring their cases. But at this point with Donald Trump, go for it. If Fannie Willis feels that she has the evidence to prove all these different counts, she should move forward.
Let's go to actually graphic 4 now, because you point out the racketeering charges. And this is the thing, people have pointed out and said how Trump acts and tends to look like a bit of a mobster character, and it's all coming together really fast because he's been charged with violating Georgia's Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. Yeah, everyone else knows that as RICO from watching mobster movies. And this federal version of the law was originally designed to prosecute mob bosses who were leading complex criminal enterprises. Georgia's version, which is one of the most expansive in the country, as you pointed out, David, allows prosecutors to weave together several alleged crimes. And in this case, conspiracy to defraud the state, false statements in writings, impersonating a public officer, forgery, computer theft, and dozens of other charges, all into one, which would carry up to 20 years in prison. More things that would potentially scare this guy. And as you guys heard them go through all these people, their names, I mean, there was a couple that stood out. Maybe the primary one was Rudy Giuliani. Here's the charges on this guy. He's charged with making false statements for allegedly lying to lawmakers by claiming that more than 96,000 mail-in ballots were counted in Georgia, despite there being no record of them having been returned to a county elections office, and that a voting machine in Michigan wrongly recorded 6,000 votes for Biden that were actually cast for Trump. So again, he does this with help. It's always been that way. He always needed help with getting these types of things pushed through. And all these names and all these figures were maybe either lower level or people you wouldn't have heard of. Some of these are bigger. And mean those others that were bigger were jumping ship before. But Rudy Giuliani apparently doesn't understand it. And by the way, the whole the irony of this is Rudy Giuliani made a name for himself, at least from what I remember, as far as taking down mobsters. Now he finds himself working with one. Am I wrong on that? He was known for taking down mobsters.
Right. No, as U.S. attorney in New York, he took down a lot of mobsters and mafia figures using RICO statutes that were applicable to federal law. Now he's going to face even more RICO stuff down in Georgia. It's just look, I'm satisfied to hear that Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, and some of the other sort of cronies around Donald Trump now have to deal with this headache. It's new for them. Obviously, Donald Trump's been indicted three other times, but for them to now have to think about going to Georgia and dealing with defense lawyers and all that, that's a really big pain in the, you know what. As for Donald Trump, I think, you know, the takeaway is it's probably nothing new to him, except to the extent that, as we've said before, he can pardon, if he wins the presidential election, he can probably wipe out the federal indictments, but he doesn't have that authority over New York and Georgia. And that's why I think those two cases remain important.
So as you guys could imagine, let's go ahead and shift gears to what Donald Trump is saying in response. It's probably similar to what you've seen before as we read through this. No, I will not bleed it the way that John likes to, but I don't have a very good Trump impression, so I can't. But this is what he truthed out over on Truth Social in response to this. So the witch hunt continues. 19 people indicated, is that what he wrote? I'm just reading it, maybe I did it wrong. He said indicated, as my brain flipped, indicated tonight, including the former president of the United States, me, by an out of control and very corrupt district attorney who campaigned and raised money on, quote, I will get Trump. And what about those indictment? There you go. Indictment documents put out today, long before the grand jury even voted, and then quickly withdrawn. Sounds rigged to me. Why didn't they indict 2.5 years ago? Because they wanted to do it right in the middle of my campaign witch hunt. Well, I don't know if he's indicated or indicted, but one of those things he's upset about, maybe both. He went on more because he's making their case for him, for them, of course, because he won't stop effing talking. He says a large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report on the presidential election fraud, which took place in Georgia, is almost complete. It will be presented by me at a major news conference at 11 o'clock on Monday of next week in Bedminster, New Jersey. Based on the results of this conclusive report, all charges should be dropped against me and others. There'll be a complete exoneration, more capitalization. They never went after those that rigged the election. They only went after those that fought to find the riggers. God, this guy. Listen, there's been multiple judges that told him to be quiet, trying to don't reveal all the things that have been talked about, discussed, evidence that they're going back and forth through publicly, because this is something that's being adjudicated in court, because, you know, he's the head of the law and order party that apparently don't have much honor for that anymore at all in their lives. But instead, he's going to continue to talk and talk about how they're going to be the ones. I can't wait for this press conference. What is it that we could possibly expect from this press conference? Something Mike Lindell-esque that would be giving us all the numbers. And this is what we've got. He's done it so many times. We've already seen it, bro. As a matter of fact, you've been in court 18 to 20 times right after you lost that election. And we're trying to see exactly how many more ways you can come up with telling us that you have no idea what you're talking about, that you're spinning your wheels. And as a matter of fact, potentially incriminating himself even further. What do you expect from this, David?
I wonder if Donald Trump is going to try to make this report so confusing and so detailed and so complex that nobody can understand it. That way, because most people are not going to read it, the media will try to pour through it, and maybe a lot of attorneys will. But if Donald Trump is able to say to his followers, I gave them a report, I showed them how there was fraud, I showed them how I won the election in Georgia, even though that's not what the report says, and even though the report has, you know, fictitious or bogus numbers or data that doesn't make any sense, as Donald Trump is known to put in these sorts of things, if he can make it so confusing that he can tell his own people, aha, we've proven it, they will then go to the polls and say, but Donald Trump has proven that he shouldn't have been indicted or indicated. And then everybody else will be looking at this report saying this is absolute nonsense. We might as well use it as toilet paper, but that doesn't matter to Donald Trump.
At all, it's his approach. It's to spin it so many times that maybe his supporters are the ones that already, you know, they don't believe anything that comes out against him anyway. But if he confuses more and more of them that are beginning to wonder, yo, this guy's got so many things happening to him. When we talk about the unprecedented nature of a president, former president, being indicated this many times, And maybe it's not the problem of the folks that are going after him. Maybe it's the problem of the guy who continues to get indicated. Yo, if it's just some random street criminal who gets indicated all the time, I feel like we believe that he's just a career-long criminal. Why does it flip in this particular situation? Someone with more power, money, and access to it for some reason wouldn't do the same things? You would think that maybe he has more reason to do these things.
I tell you what I really think of Donald Trump. This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth. In a pattern that I think is straight out of a psychology textbook.
The timing is nakedly political. Every time more bad news comes out about Hunter Biden or Joe Biden, you can set a stopwatch within hours. Some clown goes and indicts Donald Trump again. And then all of the little lemmings in the media go run and say, Trump, 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 Trump.
If you couldn't tell there, the shaven Ted Cruz back in 2015-16 timeframe when he's actually campaigning against Trump, he was talking about how crazy and horrific the things that he does is. But when it comes to, I guess, more evil Ted Cruz with the beard, he's finding new ways to excuse it. It makes you wonder what part he has in this whole thing and why he has to have such, you can say nothing, you know, but he was also in part of communications as the whole January 6th thing went down, and also as they were trying to overturn that election because of some loyalty that he feels he has to have towards Trump. But a lot of times when you see what you previously said about the same guy that you're now praising, you wonder, when did the switch flip? Even if it's legitimate, when did that switch flip for Ted Cruz? When did he start to believe that all those things about Donald Trump were no longer true, that he's this deplorable liar who will go after anyone and anyone only for himself and his own interests? And we still see it happening, and something changed in Ted Cruz. Something also apparently changed in Kevin McCarthy, because he had a couple words against Donald Trump after the 2020 election. But now he's saying this: justice should be blind. But Biden has weaponized government against his leading political opponent to interfere in the 2024 election. No proof of that, just saying it. He says now a radical DA in Georgia is following Biden's lead by attacking President Trump and using it to fundraise her political career. Americans see this through this desperate sham. It's one thing I agree with McCarthy on there is Americans definitely do see through the desperate sham, and it's all these people that are defending Trump after they previously said everything he's done is wrong and illegal and he should probably stop, and then told Trump slapped them in their face and said, get that back down on your knee, kiss this ring and go back to defending me. There you have Kevin McCarthy doing it. One more, Lindsey Graham also told Fox News how Mr. Trump spent more on legal fees than he did on campaigning for president. Mr. Graham had attempted to avoid testifying before Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis's team as she probed into Trump's attempts to overturn that election in Georgia, but ultimately testified in November of last year. So he's been running from it as well, because again, he had more parts in this whole thing. Lastly here, Schuster, I guess we always ask these questions. These folks that are trying to defend and stand up for him, even though we've seen them say the opposite in the past and probably will say it later once he's finally hit some nails, when he's nailed against the wall on these things. But where does this get their political career? No one's following. We see that Lindsey Graham getting booed at Trump events. Nobody likes Ted Cruz anywhere in America. So what is it about these defenses that are going to help them?
That's a great question.
That's the golden question.
I think you nailed the point, and that is they are putting their finger up in the wind, and they're feeling which way the wind is blowing. And even though they know that they're going to get booed at Trump rallies, and that they don't want Donald Trump to sort of be leading those sort of boos and to be leading the character assassination. So Lindsey Graham, Kevin McCarthy, Ted Cruz, I'm sure they would like nothing more than for Donald Trump to get hit by a bus or die of a heart attack, or suddenly have the poll numbers show that Republicans don't like that he's been indicted four times and they're no longer going to support him. Because I'm sure that the way these people really feel is that Donald Trump is a clown. But until that moment comes and is clear to them, you know, there's Ted Cruz in that video with the beard. I'm sure he was wearing oversized red shoes and was juggling off to the side, and Lindsey Graham as well. And they just have to, you know, they have to continue acting, I guess, and playing the role, because they know that they can survive being booed at Trump rallies, but they can't survive politically if Donald Trump himself is leading the charge against them.
something we're going to have to continue to figure out how this goes down. Maybe he'll even go to that debate and they'll attack him on that. I doubt it, though. We'll see where this all goes. But actually, you know, as we take this first break and go to some of your comments, when we get back, though, one of these main figures, though, Ron DeSantis, is still fledgling and flopping around in his campaign to try and find some footing. Maybe he's one of those ones who's hoping that Donald Trump will just kind of go away, or maybe these folks that they're criticizing will actually come and get him. But, you know, as everything continues to get spread out and delayed, they're probably beginning to worry even further. We're going to get into that. I'll see your comments in a couple of seconds. What's going on, you guys? Back on the Damage Report. J.R. Jackson in for one John Iadarola. We're just talking about Trump's indictments. More coming, this time out in Georgia. They've come to real fruition, and now he's having to deal with more. But what about Ron DeSantis? How is he responding to things? How is he doing? Maybe he's now, his campaign is now gone into full ascent, and he's doing great. Or maybe he's not. Let's jump right into this. Ron DeSantis' campaign continues to sputter along, and as it does, he's finding a little bit more opposition from people who previously supported him, but they're still trying to find ways to still like him. One particular case here is one Richard Gonsmart, and he's the head of a big restaurant chain, 117-year-old restaurant chain, and he's not very happy with Ron's migrant plan that's actually quite hateful. He didn't know what actually hit his doorsteps. And this is what he has to say in response. This owner of this 117-year-old Florida restaurant chain was forced to fire undocumented staff who had worked for his family for decades after being fined $500,000. The Miami Herald was reporting this. He's a strong supporter of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, but he told the Herald that DeSantis's immigration crackdown has gone too far and that he wants stronger protection for migrants. Yo, pause. So this strong supporter of Ron DeSantis, a big restaurant chain owner, is upset because Ron's plan that he probably supported when he did it came to his effing doorstep. Now it's a problem. Let's continue on with this hypocrisy. Because DeSantis, he did sign this law back in May, and it requires businesses with more than 25 employees to check their eligibility using E-Verify. And Gonsmart runs that old restaurant chain, and they definitely have more than 25 employees. So when they went and checked it out, he was quite heartbroken at how this happened. Gonsmart was forced to fire 19 of his employees in 2021 after federal immigration officials showed up at one of his restaurants and discovered non-compliant work documents for those staffers. Seven of them had worked for Gonsmart's family for decades. It was like family, is what he said. We think they're legal, but when they had to check, we found seven people who had been with me for 30 years. What were they doing, Gonsmart? They were paying taxes. They had children, grandchildren, and we were required to terminate them, is what he told the paper. So again, as we always see it, people don't really understand how these things affect everyone else until they're affected by it, because they think they're above anyone. So this whole line about how this superiority complex and I'm backing Ron DeSantis because he's coming after those dirty migrants, until they're your friends, until they're like your family that worked for you for 30 years. He pointed out that they pay taxes. How many Republicans have been talking about how migrants come in here, pay taxes, contribute to the American dream, and then get treated like garbage? Not many of them, until they actually have to get rid of them, and then they're hurting, and their bottom line, they're having to look for more folks, or maybe someone else that they don't have to exploit for certain types of wages have to deal with it. I want to discuss this part of it before we go further into the stumbles that Ron DeSantis' campaign is taking. Your thoughts on this first, David?
Well, I mean, like this thing about, you know, a Ron DeSantis supporter, a prominent supporter, saying that Ron DeSantis has gone too far, it echoes what we saw a couple of weeks ago, where one of Ron DeSantis's top donors, a guy named Bigelow, who had given like $20 million to a super PAC, said that DeSantis had gone too far, too extreme on abortion. DeSantis recently signed a law that criminalizes abortion after 6 weeks in Florida. A lot of women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. And so, you know, Ron DeSantis is getting pushback from sort of more moderate Republicans on that. It is interesting to see that he's also getting pushback from some of the supporters for being too extreme on anti-immigration. And it, you know, it gets to, it underscores Ron DeSantis has run a hate-based campaign, a hating of women, hating of immigrants, but he does it without the sort of smile and without the charisma of Donald Trump. And so he's paying the price for both of that lack of personality and policies that a lot of people don't like.
Is it a personality? I mean, yes, it is a lack of personality, but he's been told this is the way to approach, because again, he's the clone of Donald Trump. It's the way he painted himself as he came into, I guess, national politics. But when you have to do that, you probably have to have some kind of an approach to where you believe in it. Who knows where he believes in it? He just thinks he has to go with this most iron fist approach to all these things. And now folks that are actually affected by it, it might illustrate just how much he doesn't understand how it works. It may be for them too, because he's got other stumbles that are happening along his campaign. After he's reconfigured his leadership group, I believe his new chief of staff is someone that's never run a campaign before, and people are beginning to wonder. And we know pundits, Republican and conservative pundits, are the ones that help shape the way that their followers and these voters believe in them and what they think they're doing. They're beginning to turn too, starting here.
DeSantis has done the reset, then he did the reboot, then he did the retread. Maybe he's getting ready for the retreat, but he fires the campaign manager today. There's turmoil in there. You can tell it's just not happening, right? He's not getting traction. And when he came out and said, Trump definitely lost and Biden's a legitimate president. I think that'll take him down to single digits.
Take you down to single digits real quick. Again, we know, Bannon is all about Donald Trump, and anyone who challenges Donald Trump, he's going to eventually jump back towards him as well. So Ron DeSantis is making enemies where he doesn't really want to. But also, by the way, Charlie Kirk, another big Trumper, is talking about this as well, but he still has a little bit of hope left for Ron. Just maybe not right now. Watch that.
This was not the time for DeSantis to run. You and I both knew this. We tried to sort of warn the governor, indirectly ahead of time that 2024 wasn't really his time. 2028 would be his time. How can he flip the script? And I haven't really thought about it, until what you said, and that would be the perfect way. He could gracefully bow out. He could prevent himself from becoming an also-ran and, an afterthought. He could do all of this plus donate this $130 million, not to Trump, but to what TPUSA and other conservative groups.
All kinds of ideas coming for Ron DeSantis. Bow out, leave, come back in 4 more years, figure this all out for yourself. But you look like you're taking one for the team. You'll hand over whatever cash to super PACs and continue to support Donald Trump, and you'll look good and we'll set you up perfectly. It's all about getting that power right now, and how much will they actually support him later when they've discovered how bad of a candidate he really is personally? I'm not sure if some kind of campaign reboot or some kind of new leader may help him with this. But what else they also point out, and maybe this is probably the scariest thing that he could be compared to, is another Scott Walker. Yeah, you haven't heard that name in a while, because he ran for president and no one's heard of him since, because he was painted as a rhino, similar to the way that Donald Trump is trying to paint Ron DeSantis as one, which ironically might be why he's going so hardcore and making these enemies in places that he probably shouldn't. So this shift has also happened with these pundits as well, David. Maybe it's a bold prediction, but some, even Bannon suggesting here, maybe you should just leave. How disastrous would that be, though?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think you can do a personality transplant, even if you had 40 years, never mind 4 years. So I think him getting out of the race now is not going to help him in 2028. I think he's probably doomed in 2028. What's so interesting to me is that in a place like Iowa, where people are generally polite, even on the Republican side, I mean, he was getting booed at the Iowa State Fair, and people got more excited when Donald Trump's airplane flew over them. He was flipping hamburgers. And so, it's like the hits keep on coming. And again, I'd say the biggest difference between DeSantis and Donald Trump is, Donald Trump will say horrible things about immigrants. He'll say horrible things about women, but he does it in such a way with sort of a twinkle in his eyes, smile on his face, that he convinces a lot of his supporters to think, oh, of course he's joking. It's just a joke that they're all rapists. And they can sort of laugh and they can say, well, I don't believe that all immigrants are rapists. And Donald Trump was just sort of joking about that. Well, when Ron DeSantis bashes immigrants, there is no sort of hint of humor or lightness about it. It's as if Ron DeSantis really believes that all immigrants need to be shipped out and that all women should have no rights. And so there's no humor whatsoever. And so I think that makes even some Republicans feel a little bit uncomfortable that, well, Donald Trump has sort of been on the joke. Ron DeSantis can't laugh at himself. He can't laugh about anything. And it's, he's in third place now in Iowa, behind Mike Pence. He's in third place in New Hampshire now behind Chris Christie and Donald Trump. I mean, he's going in the wrong direction.
I wonder what he's going to pull off next. More reconfiguration, more hate. Maybe you can go after that woke stuff that's been working for him so far. Let's jump to maybe more important things, because lives and are definitely been lost and more in danger out in Hawaii. So many folks have tried to figure out exactly what it is that happened with these wildfires that have devastated so much of the state. I guess we'll start ridiculous. Let's go here.
Big fires in France right now. Big fires in Germany. When the winds get high and it's dry, out come the Extinction Rebellion leftists. And they don't like populists. They don't like people having houses. They don't like people having cars. And then obviously the globalists. So I believe arsonists did set these fires, and we have evidence we'll cover next hour of that, and people being arrested for it.
Obviously, the globalists. I mean, that doesn't even need to be said. It's obvious. Alex Jones there giving his thoughts about what's going on in Hawaii with the wildfires and the causes, and how somehow people are controlling exactly how this goes because they want it to look a certain way. I guess so. Donald Trump also had things to say about it as well, which maybe began normal, but then it went very Trumpish. Watch.
I would like to express my sympathy and warmest regards to the people of Hawaii, and specifically all of those who have been so gravely and irreparably hurt by the tragedy of the wildfires in Maui, something the likes of which have seldom been seen anywhere at any time. Our government was not prepared, and very importantly, the aftermath is going very poorly, with the governor of the island wanting to do nothing but blame it on global warming and other things that just happened to pop into his head. When asked about it today, as he was getting into a car, perhaps coming home from the beach, where he has been spending a great deal of time, crooked Joe Biden, the most incompetent president in the history of our country, with a laugh and a smile, said he had no comment on the death and the tragedy. To say no comment is oftentimes fine, but to be smiling when you say it, especially against such a tragedy as this, is absolutely horrible and unacceptable.
We know politicians trying to find any way to capitalize off of anything, especially when it comes to tragedies within the country. But it usually is masked a little better than that. It's a horrible tragedy that's happening in Hawaii. And can you believe Joe Biden? He had a smile on his face. Okay. Anybody who actually would jump onto that already hates Joe Biden anyway, for many other reasons that Donald Trump has told folks. But this is supposed to be some kind of way for him to get himself inserted into it. Again, nakedly, obviously, him just trying to promote himself. A little more of what actually is going on in the state and how many actual people are affected by it. So as of Monday afternoon, though, officials confirmed that 99 people have died, which is up from the previous count of 96. The governor, Josh Green, told CNN on Monday that the death toll would likely increase very significantly, and it could double over the next 10 days. An unknown number of people are still unaccounted for, as search teams with cadaver dogs look for remains in devastated neighborhoods. And while FEMA earlier Saturday said it was premature to assign even an approximate dollar amount to the damage done to Maui, the governor estimated that the losses approached $6 billion. A little bit more, firefighters have made progress against the three largest wildfires, but the deadly fire in hard-hit Lahaina, I hope I said that right, covering more than 2,000 acres, was only 85% contained by Sunday afternoon. Let's check out this picture that was tweeted out about the difference between one before and after. It looks like it's out of some kind of an apocalypse movie. And we've seen that in California and other places when we had wildfires happen. So a little bit more for what the government is doing, though, David. You spend any time in Hawaii, and the dryness of what is that's happened, it's very similar to the things that happened out in California. But the devastation that's happening there, of course, is affecting the folks who live there versus how much tourism is coming in and out.
So I was in Maui 15 years ago for vacation, and went to Lahaina and went to some of the resorts that are 30 miles sort of to the south. You know, it's hard to imagine that a place like that, that you associate with sort of, you know, tropical and rainforest in certain areas, and then volcano and dry in others, that would suddenly, you know, become this sort of inferno so quickly. But it sounds like a lot of people, I mean, the winds came in. The winds then shifted directions before people had a chance to realize what was going on. Nobody sort of knew how to escape. And before anybody got any sort of warning, they see smoke and flames literally down the block. And then they pull into the sort of main road, and everybody's trying to leave. And there's a traffic jam, and the flames are getting closer. Yeah. Some people then abandon their cars and run to the water. it sounds like an absolute nightmare, and certainly was a nightmare. And unfortunately, with some with flames this intense, and I don't want to be too sort of graphic about it, but unless you have DNA of the people who were killed, some of them may not be identifiable, and it'll be hard to sort of make a match. So unfortunately, I think there are going to be a lot of people who have gone missing who will never be recovered.
So of course, the next question, or at least the discussion that I'm sure many folks who are opponents of it as well, is talking about the conditions and how it's been facilitated by our lack of addressing climate change issues and man-made aspects of it, but just the conditions that are ripe for this type of thing, and then it could lead to something this huge. A really fast response being from the administration, also FEMA itself. The administrator, Deanne Criswell, said that the federal government has the quote right amount of personnel on the ground. She says, we know and we have let them know that we're mourning with them. Nothing can prepare you for what I saw during my time here, and nothing can prepare them for the emotional toll of the impact that the severe event has taken on them. And also, Biden apparently has no plans to visit the state, which, in my opinion, it's always been that type of thing. I don't need presidents to show up in disaster areas and roll up their sleeves on their collared shirts and say, we're doing something. You can do something. You can send people who actually do something. Your ass being there has nothing to do with it. But this is what was tweeted out from Biden. FEMA's temporary sheltering assistance is now available for residents who were displaced from their homes by the wildfires, allowing survivors to shelter in hotels or motels temporarily as they develop a long-term housing plan. And we're laser focused on getting aid to survivors, including critical needs assistance, a one-time $700 payment per household offering relief during an unimaginably difficult time. We have staff on the ground dedicated to helping survivors navigate the registration process. We saw when COVID hit and then, you know, some dollars went out, $700, I don't know, man. I don't know, and how much it can do for them. And, you know, I don't have the numbers behind what it could be and what it should be. But again, this island, this state that is run through all this tourism and everything, but folks who have lived there and maybe are native to the island, I'm not sure how much it's really helping them after how many of the resources get taken out and you know, put towards just tourism in the first place. I haven't been to Hawaii. I always wanted to go. It seems like it's less and less likely to happen. Your last thoughts on this, David?
I hope that at some point, JR, that they do open up Maui again and say, okay, tourism is going to be a major driver, and we're going to offer incentive for JR to come out to Maui, because it is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And that's, I think, in some ways, so many people have been there because it is such a beautiful place, and people are so friendly as well in places like Lahaina. It's just, it's heartbreaking on countless levels.
We'll see where it goes. Hopefully containment continues to happen, and rebuilding is actually something we're committed to, and not after this week is over. We tend to forget what's happening right afterwards, because we're driven in the middle of this presidential candidacy. All right, you guys, let's take this next break, a few more of your comments. But also, when we get back, we've got Wisconsin doing something similar that I've seen from back, I believe it was North Carolina. You know, there's folks in office that are elected, but of course, the officials that are against it are trying to get them removed because of normalcy, maybe some regularity. We'll do that. We'll do that out in Wisconsin when we get back. Back on the Damage Report, you guys. Glad to have you. Let's jump straight into this next story. Man, we're running long time, aren't we? Let's go straight into this out in Wisconsin. As politics continues to run on, we'll see as people get elected, some folks just aren't very happy about it. They still have to fight to keep the progress that we then made. In a radio interview on Friday, Wisconsin Assembly member Robin Voss accused the state Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz of, quote, prejudging the outcome of a potential case challenging the legality of Wisconsin's electoral maps and their gerrymandered maps. Let's get into the details of that. The Republican leader of Wisconsin's assembly late last week threatened impeachment proceedings against that state Supreme Court justice if she doesn't recuse herself from cases involving Wisconsin's legislative maps, which GOP lawmakers have aggressively gerrymandered to give themselves what experts say is an illegal electoral advantage. Supreme Court justices in Wisconsin, of course, are elected, and she just won her term in April of this year. Let's check out that by what, 11 percentage points, so pretty devastatingly. But now they're looking to limit her position and what is it she can do in that. So the lawsuit that they put forward says this: the Campaign Legal Center, Law Forward, the Election Law Clinic at Harvard Law School, Stafford Rosenbaum, and Arnold and Porter argued in a petition filed with the Wisconsin Supreme Court earlier this month that the state's legislative maps are, quote, extreme partisan gerrymanders that violate multiple provisions of the Wisconsin Constitution. They're pointing out the truth here. The lawsuit demands a redrawing of legislative maps and special elections for state Senate seats that wouldn't otherwise be up for a re-election until 2026. Protasiewicz, whose election victory earlier this year ended conservatives' 15-year dominance in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, was critical of the state's maps during her campaign, calling them rigged and arguing that they do not reflect the people of this state. So what's the reality about these maps and her stances here and now them trying to silence her? Though the Wisconsin Constitution requires legislative districts to consist of a contiguous territory, many nonetheless contain sections of land that are not actually connected. Wisconsin's nationally peculiar practice of detached districts is cited as one of several alleged violations in a recent lawsuit seeking to strike down current assembly and Senate districts and replace them before the 2024 election. So they're supposed to have all these district maps in one particular, it's supposed to touch at least, so you can have a reason for why it's there. But they keep breaking them up because it's more beneficial to them to retain power, despite the fact that they actually aren't getting the same numbers of votes in that manner. Let's look at this vote share versus some of the seats that they do get. So as you can see, Tony Evers, who had won at 51.2% here, and the Republican behind him, 47.8. Also in the state legislature, as you can see, Republicans have 64 in the assembly to the 35 Democrats, despite the fact that the numbers that voted for them is so much different, as you can see from the number of Democratic voters versus Republican ones, because of the gerrymandered points. And they can still have some level of control without really winning to a high enough degree. So even if the Republican controlled Wisconsin Senate doesn't ultimately succeed in convicting Protasiewicz, her impeachment in the assembly would, under Wisconsin law, prevent her from hearing any cases until her acquittal. So if nothing else, David, they're at least delaying this long enough and keeping her from actually doing her job to a degree, because you know, in America, that's democracy.
Now, what an absolute sham. I mean, this is so ridiculous. I hate gerrymandering and the drawing of districts to so heavily favor one party or another. It's a problem. But the idea that, I mean, this is essentially a fake impeachment, right? Because even if they can't get through with the impeachment, well, they can sideline her. That's her strategy. They lost the election. She was elected to the state Supreme Court, but because they cannot accept election results, now they have to sideline her on all cases that are involving gerrymandering. It's absolutely ridiculous. And at a certain point, you'd like to think that even like the Wisconsin Republican Party would have some shame. Usually Midwesterners are a little bit more polite and earnest than other parts of the country. But no, in Wisconsin, they're just as loony tunes.
Yeah, it's crazy though. Like, so these are things that happen right in front of us in broad daylight. We've seen gerrymandering, we've seen challenges to it. In fact, gerrymandering happens on both sides of the aisle. But then whenever there's this lesser number of voters that actually have your back, and then the next step is then to just go forward with acting like you have some kind of mandate. Many times we talk about how Donald Trump is the one who lighted this fire under many Republicans to just kind of cheat their way through elections and power control. But they've been doing this for a while now, and maybe maybe their boldness has been growing since. But in this particular one, who pays attention to Wisconsin, in particular this state Supreme Court justice, and where they're standing with gerrymandering outside of folks of Wisconsin? It's kind of happening in broad daylight, but how much do we really pay close attention to it? Do you see major news networks talking about it? And that's not to criticize them. Where's the time to do that type of stuff? It's why they can see themselves doing this straightforward in front of everyone there. Before we get out of this hour, let's do one more here. Shift gears over to, maybe you guys have seen the movie. I haven't, but Michael Orr from the Blind Side movie has come forward, and he's making some news, and people are talking. The 2009 movie The Blind Side, about former NFL player Michael Orr, is now getting some new wrinkles, because as we know, the whole story is about how he was adopted by this family and he's propelled to NFL greatness. He's the gentle giant. Well, him now being at the center of this whole controversy is pushing back on that whole thing that they saved his life. Orr asked the Tennessee court on Monday to formally end his legal relationship with the family who took him in, claiming that he had never actually been adopted and had been tricked into signing away his decision-making powers so that family could take tons of money off of his story and his life. Let's go to these details from the New York Times. Michael Orr is 37 years old, and he's seeking a termination of the conservatorship. Geez, when Britney did this, I fell over that word. Conservatorship that began when he was 18, plus money that he says he should have earned from the movie, as well as an injunction preventing Lee Ann Tui and Sean Tui from using his name and his likeness. This is what the petition was saying. The families of classmates often let Orr, who fell through the cracks of a quote, broken social system, stay in their homes, where other parents of Michael's classmates saw Michael simply as a nice kid in need. Conservators Sean and Lee Ann saw something else, a gullible young man whose athletic talent could be exploited for their own benefit. Now, this petition, which was filed in Shelby County in Tennessee, claims that when he thought he was being adopted, the Tuis urged him to sign a conservatorship in which he relinquished his ability to enter into contracts. The lawsuit also claims that Orr, who started living with the Tuis at age 16, unknowingly signed away the rights to his life story for that same movie by 20th Century Fox in 2007, just a couple years before it then came out. And also lastly, in Tennessee, a conservatorship is defined as an arrangement in which a court removes at least some decision-making powers and duties from a person with a disability who lacks the capacity to make decisions in one or more important areas. And then it grants those duties to a conservator or conservators or co-conservators. The 04 order that granted his conservatorship to the Tuis states that Orr appeared to have no known physical or psychological disabilities. This is something I wondered all the time, David, because I never saw the movie. I'm not sure if you did. But I guess my read on it was something was wrong with the way Michael Orr could handle his business and could see the way he could progress throughout his life. So he needed this help. And again, it's because I didn't pay attention close to your story and didn't see the movie, didn't read anything to the books, anything about it. But the fact that he's coming out now, I think he's dispelling many of those things that people like me thought just on a very casual level, first of all. And then secondly, they're now fighting back when it comes to this. I'm not sure what this can do for them, but your first thoughts here.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think he was far more independent than a lot of folks seem to believe, or many of us sort of knew. I didn't see the movie either or follow much about the story, but there was always something about whenever you take a child, now he wasn't a child, but a teenager, and then you turn a movie about them and your adoptive parents, or any parents for that matter, it seems a little bit like exploitation. But I didn't really sort of think much about it. Now it seems that it was total exploitation, that the family was far more concerned about the financial gain, what they would benefit from this movie. And I had always thought, well, maybe he, you know, they made the movie with his blessings and he was part of it and he encouraged it because he also was signed onto this amazing story. And to come to find out that no, that wasn't the case, that he was sort of snookered into this and that he doesn't have any sort of financial gain that he's made out of this and that it's only this family that somehow has benefited is really disheartening and sad, frankly.
There was always a lot of folks who were I guess critical of the way the movie came off, and you know, it was, even if it was the hero, you know, the white savior type of movie that was coming through. But this new wrinkle, I think, maybe adds more to that. So, of course, the folks who are the targets of this have responded as well, the Tui family. Sean told the Daily Memphian that he was devastated by these allegations and the family didn't take any money off of the Blind Side film. There's details here. He says, it's upsetting to think that we would make money off of any of our children. We're going to love Michael at 37, just like we loved him at 16, is what he said. And at the Blind Side book, author Michael Lewis gave us half of his share, but he maintained that everybody in the family got an equal share, including Michael. And he said that number was $14,000 that each of them got. Also, Sean also said that the conservatorship was a route to helping secure Orr's eligibility to play college football. Also saying that lawyers had advised the family they couldn't adopt over the age of 18 and that the only thing we could do was have a conservatorship. He said that he would have been willing to end it if Orr wanted that. I don't know. At this point, again, 37 years old, Orr is retired. Whatever monies he made in the NFL, I'm not sure the degree or even the relationship he had with the Tuis, I hope I'm saying the name right, throughout the rest of his career really meant a lot, or how much of it they got, or what the relationship really was, but maybe it was strained for a long time, and now we now have this new wrinkle to jump on, and I'm sure people are taking sides based off of what we really don't know. So I mean, I when it comes to 14K for the movie, and then the rest of his career, and getting him to college, I wonder to what degree they did help, or if it started as this positive help this kid out type of thing, and then it turned into this kid just might go pro. people's objectives shift sometimes when they see what's going on, but we'll never really know. Hopefully everyone at least has some kind of a end game here where no one's fully hurt or their financial status really isn't happening that bad, or they haven't dug into anything in the future for Michael Orr, but he is coming out speaking at least to have his own voice. Your last thoughts here, David?
I'd be curious. So Michael Lewis is a pretty well-known, esteemed, incredible author. We haven't really heard from him about this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for those of us who aren't quite sure what to believe, I'd be curious if some journalist actually talks to the author, Michael Lewis, and gets his take on, okay, was there anything weird that you saw? Was there anything that was not on the up and up? Was somebody taking advantage of somebody else? Because he would probably have a pretty interesting perspective on all of that.
I'm gonna have to watch the movie and see how they depicted it. Because, you know, I'll start a book and get through the first four chapters and then something just kind of happens. So my bad, it's just how it is. Okay, so you guys, let's take this break now as we go in this first hour. But of course, up next, we've got the pre-port. We've got the post-show, so hold on to your butts, as you guys are going to see in a second. We'll come back with more stories. Me and David Schuster, we'll see you guys in a couple minutes.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.